Support for Gig with Mike Redman comes from Music Connection. For 45 years, connecting artists and musicians with each other and the industry. And you can find them on the web at musicconnection.com. Welcome, audio aficionados, to another episode of Gig with Mike Redman. And today, we're diving deep into the world of sonic mastery with a true legend of the recording industry. None other than the recording engineer extraordinaire, Jimmy Douglas, also known as the Senator. If sound could be sculptured into gold, then Jimmy Douglas might be the craftsman behind that masterpiece. With a career spanning decades, he shaped the sound of some of the most iconic albums and artists across all genres. Jimmy is as down-to-earth as they come. He's humble, with a confidence that he needs to make his clients feel comfortable in the right hands, if you know what I mean. And we just had a great talk. Jimmy, thanks for joining me on Gig, man. I really appreciate your time. You look exactly like you do in all the other YouTube videos and interviews I've seen you on. You know, you don't age like ever. It's kind of wild. If you don't mind, I'm just going to jump in. And for people that don't know you, Jimmy Douglas, would you tell our listeners what it is that you do? And maybe it's kind of like you're talking to your grandmother.
I'm Jimmy Douglas, and I am a producer. I'm an engineer. I'm a musician. I'm a songwriter. I'm all of it. Why am I all of it? Because you can do all of it. If you've got the tools,
yeah.
A little bit of talent, and I also have a lot of experience. So, like, I've produced and engineered a lot of great records. And when I think my new, I guess the one you'd pin on me is the Timberland era. Like, I did all the records with Timberland. Most of you know who he is, and he kind of has a signature on the hip hop world. And that's who I end up being lately. But I go back as far as, like, you know, I used to do jazz. I used to do Aretha Franklin, Rolling Stones, you name it. And yeah, that's in a nutshell.
That's funny. A four-decade nutshell in 40 seconds. Yeah, my life, I can wrap it up in 40 seconds, man. So I'm going to ask, what's the story behind your nickname, The Senator? I love that.
That came with when I ended up, you know, like I had this long period of a career doing rock and roll and all that stuff and R&B and funk and all of that. And then as music changed a little bit, that's when I, met Timberland, and we were doing stuff, and we were about to come out to the world with Genuine and Aaliyah and all these things. And just Timberland said to me, he says, not really understanding where I came from, my lineage, you know, he's a young kid. He says, you can't be Jimmy Douglas. I'm like, why not? And he goes, because you got to have a handle, man, when you come out. You know, people got to think, you know, some fresh whatever. And I said, okay. What is it? So I always remember this, by the way. Back in the day with Lauryn Hill, the guy who was doing her records was Commissioner Gordon.
Oh, no kidding.
I don't know his real name, but that's what he billed himself as. And I always thought, whoa, that is so slamming, you know? So when I was thinking of something, I was thinking, well, let's see, how about a name? He said President. I said, nah, President's too heavy. I don't want all that, you know?
Yeah.
But I could be a senator. Because basically this whole recording game, as I've known it since a kid till now, it's so political. It's one half music and one half politics.
Yep.
And, you know, basically I'm the guy in the middle running shop between the companies and the artists and all the pieces in the middle. And that's how it all works. And there's the name of the senator.
The senator and also the negotiator. or the guy that steps back when they go like this, you kind of just.
That's exactly right.
Here.
That's, that's a better description. I'm the guy that suddenly goes, oh, I'm not the producer on this one. So
you guys decide. There's only a million ways we can do this. I'm gonna tax your brain just for a second. I'll try not to do that too much today. But, you know, looking back, I mean, you really have had an amazing career, and you've recorded with, you know, the who's who of our whole generation, especially our generation. You know, could you like recall a session or two that you thought would just define like why you love this business?
Yeah. I'll say, well, there's one session that did happen to me that was very, very special. Uh-huh. It was unique in its own right. And I've told this story sometimes, and not as many times I'd like to, but it had to do with Les McCann. Mm-hmm. And it was a session when it was around the time when Miles Davis had done Bitches Brew. So now in the jazz world, the whole thinking of it was like to do like this effortless, thoughtless stream of consciousness music. In other words, heretofore, the jazz people would like, there'd be somebody who'd write a part and everybody would play their parts around the part that was written and we all knew where we were going. Mm-hmm. When he did Bitches Brew, it was just a free-for-all. There was a lick, ming, and then everybody kind of jumped in. Uh-huh. So Les McCann comes into the studio, and this record was produced by Joel Doran. I don't know if you know who Joel Doran is, but he's up at Atlantic Records. He would have produced Roberta Flack and most of the jazz people. He was in that department under Nestle Erdogan. So Les McCann, I think I had done with another record with him and Eddie Harris before. But Les comes into the studio and he has basically, the lineup is like 17 people. Wow. But we don't know what they're going to be doing. And Joel just says, Joel was the kind of producer. He was the kind of producer who would sit with a newspaper while the session's going on, laughing, getting the greatest musicians in the world. Mm-hmm. And he was the producer because he knew how to let them do what they had to do. Right. He was that producer. Yeah. Yeah. So once again, here we are, and he doesn't know what's going to happen. He has no clue. And all I know is 70 people are coming. I got two sets of drums to set up, a percussionist as well. So that's really almost three sets of drums. I got a percussionist that does some sort of stuff. That's a fourth one. Then I've got a piano. Then I've got a Fender Rhodes. And then so the piano and the Fender Rhodes are playing. And then I've got a guitar. And I've got two basses. Two basses, that's right. And then I've got a harp, a true live harp in the room.
Yeah. Wow.
And so everybody shows up and I'm like sitting here trying to figure out how to get sounds from people.
Yeah.
Like it's a lot of people, a lot of bodies to go through to get sounds. One of the people was, one of the percussionists was Yusef Lateef.
Oh, wow.
Okay. So, he's just versatile. So he's got a mic here and a mic here for stuff. And it's like, I don't know what's going on yet. One of the drummers, one of the drummers was Bernard Purdy.
Oh,
On this particular record, he was playing gong.
And gong?
Yeah, because Alphonse Mouzon was another drummer. Oh, so this session was just full of high-powered, I think Bill Salter on bass was one of the bass players, David Spinoza on guitar. And Les, but the way this session kind of panned out, as you may know from doing sessions, musicians, when they come, especially paid for hire, they got to get loose. They don't just walk in and start playing. They got to get some coffee. They got to talk about what happened on the weekend, all this other stuff. And I'm sitting there going, can I get some help here? Can somebody play something? Uh-huh. And so Les, I had the Rhodes right in front of the window so I could see him. Uh-huh. I could, the director, leader, and he's right there. And I think Cornell was on the record too, playing guitar. There was two guitars. And so he starts talking to him about something. And I still haven't gotten one sound. The room was just full of empty mics and everybody's out in the hall hanging out or whatever they're doing. And so he's talking to him and all of a sudden he just plays a note and I go, well, shit, well, I just might as well start while he's talking to him and we'll work from there. I push the record on the tape machine while he's playing the line and he starts playing the line. Do, 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 do. That was the lick with the bass Rhodes. Shit was sick. Bow, do, 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 do. And the guitar was like, oh. And he just picks it up and he goes, dun, 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 dun. And they're like, okay. So now all of a sudden I'm going, that's pretty cool. Now somebody walks in, one of the drummers, and they go, oh, this is what's happening? He just jumps on the drums and starts playing. Boo, doo, doo, boo, and they boo, boo. 21 minutes later, everybody had been in. We had done the record, and the record went from like quiet to like bashing out on sound, and we were all sitting there and I haven't gotten a sound yet.
Oh no.
Well, the tape was running.
Yeah.
Me and Joel were sitting there looking, going, what the fuck is going on? This is the most incredible freeform stream of consciousness I've ever heard. And then literally when they kind of got done, we're in the 22 minute range, running the tape at the speed we're running, 15 IPS. So you get maybe 25 minutes or 20, whatever. So a little buffer in the front. Literally, when they stopped playing, a half a minute later, the fucking tape rolled off the machine. And I was like, holy shit, what the fuck was that? And then they all came in and we listened and we were all blown the fuck away. Because it was like literally, he didn't say anything to anybody except for that one person. They all just jumped in and they just started doing this. And like, for instance, Yusuf Lateef in the middle of it, he suddenly pulls out a seashell. Like, I'm sitting there going, what is that sound? And I'm like, what the fuck? And I'm looking and there it was. And
shell.
So I'm just saying, like, where did that come from? And I talked to Bernard Purdy about maybe a year or two ago, and I was saying, Bernard, you remember that session? Blah, 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 blah. Because it was two drummers. It was his main drummer that was there. And I said, Bernard was playing gong. And then he goes, no, man. He says, in the middle, I switched with Alphonse Mouzon.
No shit.
Yes, they did. And there was so much going on with the music. Like, I didn't see it. I didn't, because everything was just going on. And he goes, yeah, no, man, right in the middle, he got off the drums. He went to my position and I went to the drums and I started playing. And I was like, yo.
Holy crap.
Right. That's, and there's no cameras running. So like, we can't see anything. It's really about my memory and about them. And that's, so here's the other part of that. As musicians, as they are, they all heard the take and we all agreed this was probably the most fabulous thing that happened. But of course, somebody's like, teacher, we can do a better take.
Oh, of course they can.
Of course. Right. Exactly. But we proceeded to try that 3 or 4 times more. Nope. That was the one. And once again, that was the one that I accidentally or just happened to be running the tape. Because what would have happened, we would have been trying to we'd have been chasing what we imagined in our heads. So that's that is the take on that. It's Invitation to Openness is the album. And I think that song is The Lovers. That's what it's called.
I'm going to look that up. That's amazing. The part that you're not leaving out, which, you know, as an engineer, the other engineers would think this, is like, you just happen to have all the levels at a place where you were getting it, but not, it wasn't, you know, overloading and, or you were freaking out during this, kind of making sure that we get everything in here so that it's not crazy.
I never freak out. That's not my nature. That's what we don't do. That's one thing I don't do.
Well, we never show them.
One of my assistants once said to me, I was in we were doing a session and I think we were doing some Foreigner sessions and he was, the kid was okay. He used to work with Eddie Kramer, you know? And so he was okay. And I always noticed that he did a lot of stuff, but he was always really good. And I said to him, I said, Randy, it's amazing. You keep doing this, but you never fuck up. And he said to me, you never catch me.
Exactly. Yep.
I never forget that. I was like, damn, you got me on that one. And since that day, I'm always looking out for what I'm always looking around going, what's going on with people? Like, like I didn't catch, you know, just like I didn't catch Bernard changing the drums.
Yeah.
Alphonse, because there was so much going on, you know? And the thing, the music, it ebbed up and down. So there was a period where the drums weren't really playing.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't have missed it. It wasn't like, you know, the guy's playing a regular beat and you know what's happened. It's just like ting, ting. And somewhere in there, they switched over.
That's crazy. That's crazy that they could communicate that way. That is so cool. Down in Miami, I mentioned I was a Criterion with the Bee Gees and Streisand and Crosby, Stills, Nash in there. And Tom Dowd was also roaming the halls. And you've credited Tom multiple times with kind of being a mentor and somebody that you watch really closely as you were, you know, becoming who you are and learning. And what was so special about the guy?
There was something about Tom that to this day I can't describe what about him was different, but the guy was just different. When I say different, Understand one thing. When I walked into the studio, I had no reference of what a studio was. I had no reference of what anybody did. I had no reference of the whole thing. So just watching this guy do his thing was amazing in its own right. Not understanding I'm watching probably one of the most prolific people at doing that job in the world. I don't know that. I just think everybody does this. And this guy, he would talk to his console. You know, I watched him. I would watch him mix. The first album I saw him mix was first album I ever saw mixed, actually. But and he would do it at night alone, and it was the Dusty in Memphis album. You know, Breakfast in Bed, all that stuff, all those records. And I was like the kid doing tape copies in the hall, so I would just come and watch him. And I always managed to stay out of his way, so he let me do it. He let me see him. He let me watch. And the thing that was interesting was like he would talk to the music. And I thought, wow, that's really interesting. He was orchestrating the music and the board and talking to them as if they were animated human beings.
Wow.
I adapted a lot of that because I do I talk to my instruments and my parts, and I do talk to them, you know. That's one of the things that he did that was real special. And you know, Tom did things like I had heard that I wasn't there when he did this because I came way after Otis Redding had passed. But Jerry Greenberg, who was then when I came, he became the president of Atlantic, and he was telling a story about how he would roam the halls at night, and anything could happen up in the studio because the studio was attached to the record company. So that was number one. So it was one big happy family.
And, that's so cool.
Very cool. You know, Jerry would go from his executive position to walk in the back of the studio, play producer, blah, 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 back and forth. And so there was no emailing mixes.
MP3 didn't exist yet.
And we didn't talk about the internet, but I'm saying it wasn't even a matter of FedEx getting mixed. FedEx me the mix. No, it's a matter of like walk down the hall, play it in Jerry's office. No, fix this. Boom, go back to the studio, fix it. But Jerry Greenberg was telling a story about walking up and down the halls, and he goes, you know, anything was liable to happen at those nights. You walk back, he goes, and like I'd walk by and I see Tom Dowd putting a guy whistling on an Otis record. I went, no, that wasn't Otis. Because I remember as a kid, I was very emotional with that record, Doc. I was very emotional with it.
That's one of still today is one of my very, very favorite songs.
Very favorite. And and plus, you know, Otis had died by then.
Yeah.
They released that record after he had crashed, the plane crash. So I knew he had died, and I all liked his older stuff. And I'm a kid, and you're very tender when you're a kid, you know. And when he said that, I was like, one of the reasons I really cry when that record played, because I envisioned Otis sitting on the dock whistling before he died.
Oh, my God. Wow.
That's my image of that whole thing. It's like, Tom, I mean, Jerry, you just busted my whole thing.
So much for those tears, man.
Tom
came in when we finished our album, listened to it one time, and sequenced the album. He listened to it one time, and he said, okay, this needs to be number one, this song needs to be number two, and he walked out, and that was it, and that's exactly how it was released.
And that was it, and that's how Tom was to me. He would do simple stuff that was just like, and be gone.
Yeah.
And, you know, people go, like you said, credited him, like, I'm like, Tom never sat and taught me anything. He never sat and said, now, Jimmy, we're going to do this. He would just be there. He would do stuff. You'd pick it up and you go, and somehow osmosis would just fill you up. And you walk away talking and feeling like this man.
For our listeners, I'm hoping that, you know, young people get to listen to you and learn and kind of soak some of this in, because that environment doesn't exist anymore. You know what I mean? I mean, it's gone. And so actually along that line, is mentoring and interning still a thing in the studio?
Well, so here's what I have found.
Mm-hmm.
For a bunch of years, I've been finding it hard to find interns. And one of the people that actually came to my studio and actually sort of did a course with me for a year instead of going to full stand, he was like, let's just do that here. Can you do that? Of course I can teach you this. Well, we started making videos, little jokes, because I'd have him cleaning the bathroom or something, or sweeping something. And he goes, all right, I've done what you said, but what's that got to do with the recording? And we start laughing.
Yeah.
In other words, you don't need all that anymore. You don't need to come here and learn and sweep the bathrooms to learn this craft. You get a laptop, you go online, you can learn this craft. What's not there is the interaction with the people that we were both experiencing, which gives you the next level of communication and sharing knowledge and information. Mm. It's now down to it's a me system. I have my computer. I can make any music I want. I can do all the parts. Like you've been in a band, so you know one of the things that's I call it a double-edged sword. I used to hate, especially when producing something. I'm like, okay, everybody get together. I'm the director. I like a movie. I'm the guy pulling this together. I know you all play great. That's why I picked you all, or you're with the band. Mm-hmm. So we're all going to do this. I'm going to direct it. Great. So here's what would happen a lot. Okay, so we need like that A flat chord you're playing? Maybe we can do the second inversion that kind of goes whatever. Mm-hmm. Oh, you don't want that, man. Actually, this chord isn't really good for that. You don't really want that chord. Yeah, I really do. Maybe a guy didn't have a knowledge of how to do another inversion. He goes, there ain't no other would play this chord. And then, of course, I'd have to go grab the guitar, play the chord in another position and go, really, what's this? And then he goes, oh. So that was one of the downfalls of it. Like many times, you'd have a bunch of people playing parts that you would like to hear some other parts, and they won't just give it to you. They give you a hard time. You know, that's what that was. Yeah, I will say with the computer, I don't have to deal with that. I get exactly the part I want. What I don't get is those happy accidents that happen amongst a bunch of people playing. Even like I described that Les McCann session. I'm not going primitively that far back. I'm not sure we want to do all that. But that whole thing happened because people were just interacting with each other.
Right.
Creating another level of harmony.
That is interesting. The whole control thing is something, isn't it? Because back when I was recording, I was the primary writer. And I was a young kid, and I thought I knew everything about everything. and the thing is, I had a keyboard player from New York that was way more knowledgeable than me. But at the time, you know, this is my song. Don't screw with it. You know what I mean? I don't want to change that thing because that's the way I want to hear it, even if it wasn't the right thing. And so I get it. And of course, as you grow up and you get past the point where anybody wants to hear your music, then you've learned that lesson. What are a couple of the biggest changes that you've seen, you know, positive or negative or both, since you started in this industry back in the 70s?
I'll tell you what isn't a big change.
Okay.
And I remark on this all the time. Those in power are still acting like those in power acted like back then.
Yeah.
It's kind of pretty much the same filter, the same model, even though they've redecorated the house, put up different walls and stuff. Same thing. There's somebody at the top telling people down below, blocking a lot of people that have talent, because a lot of people that maybe don't have talent know somebody, so they get to go in the door. And that's, you know, because I listen to a lot of kids going, oh, I can't get this and I can't get that. And I'm thinking, I can tell you stories about people and acts that we had that didn't happen for the same, and vice versa. I mean, there's other stories that where somebody got something to happen because some event happened to their left or to their right, and they happened to be a part of the event rather than being the main course, but they got the benefit of it.
Yeah.
So those things are still exactly in place.
And that's sort of what you're talking about in the beginning, that you get the creative side and then you got the political side.
Right.
The political side hasn't really changed much.
Nope. It can't.
It probably never will.
No. Yeah. Well, okay. So this is another discussion. When AI does take over, it will change.
Oh, go ahead and talk about that for a minute.
They have different needs. Listen, they have different needs than we do. Every day I sit and I look around and I go, oh, there's toothpaste. Well, first of all, they don't need toothpaste. So there goes one industry that they don't fucking need. Right. Yeah. Okay. But if they did need toothpaste, guess what? They only need one brand. They don't need 100 brands. And then they don't need 100 people selling the brands. And then that whole, everything around it all the stuff that we spend our time doing, they don't need to do any of that. So I'm not going to get into, like, you know, eventually the eradication of the human. I'm not going to go that deep. No, no, but I'm going to the simple thing. Clothes. They'll just have whatever they all decided is what we need. They're going to have that. They're not going to have 50 varieties so that they can get ass and buy houses. Mm-hmm. And they don't need all that. Yeah. Their whole society will be built totally different. Ooh. So, which begs me to wonder, they don't really need one of the things that we need as humans, or I should say, one of the things we've learned to rely on.
Yeah.
Is the beauty of what music and the frequencies do to our bodies. And it does a certain calming thing, or, I mean, it can lead us either way. Sure. It can make you crazy. It can make you all those things, because they're programmed the way they are. And they're all feeling the same. They're all programmed the same. Theoretically, they don't need those things. They don't need music. What does it do for them? They don't need it. Right? If they want to calm down, you write a code. You don't fucking need music to do that. So suddenly, there cuts out that whole industry. They don't need entertainment from movies. They're just being programmed. So, you know, the biggest question I'm going to have is, like, they don't theoretically have a leader, but somewhere in there, a human's going to stick his two cents in, which is that whole thinking, and then that'll be all the science fiction movies we see about AI and da-da-da-da and eradicating humans. But that's what I think all the time. I pick up stuff and I look at stuff and I go, they don't need all this variety. They're going to have 1 billionth of the workload that we have here as humans.
That's pretty deep, though. That's a really... it is. It's because I ask pretty much everybody I interview right now, you know, what's your take on all this? And I'm getting a lot of different thoughts, and a lot, most of it's, we're gonna have to wait and see what's happening with this stuff. It's just too new. Why should a songwriter today, based on the fact that you said everybody can kind of do their own thing, right? Why should they invest in professional recording, mixing, and mastering?
I think that you would want to do that to, theoretically, I'll relate it to, like, you know, I'll relate it to records that I've been on that were, like, massively huge, that we spent a lot of time getting a lot of detail. And when the records blew and they sold millions and millions and millions, that's when the detail did count. Maybe we didn't spend the time doing all that. We might have had, like, the little, a little bit of a hit here, but it may not go to the next level for whatever reason. As a songwriter, I think that, the question I think that I would have liked to have, I think I can answer better, is, like, when do you go ahead and spend the extra money? Because, I mean, you know, if you're songwriting, you're doing it every day, you're going to probably do a good 200-300 songs a year easily. That's my opinion. And you can't get them all mastered and mixed and
Good point.
It's too much money for supposition, because, you know, let's face it, until it's picked, it's just a song.
Yeah, and there are lots of them. Yeah.
and there's lots of, exactly. So my thing is, like, when do you decide to go to that next level and do that? Well, you'll have your one or two, you know, you'll have your little list. I always call it your little list. All songwriters, I'm like, you got to have your top 20 songs somewhere in your life. I don't want to hear, please don't come here and play me 300 songs. I'm sorry.
Yep.
I lose, after a while, I lose objectivity. I do.
Sure.
And I can't hear, and I'm numb to everything. So it's like, spare me. You've done the research. Give me your best five, even. Let's work from there. And so if you have your best five, your best 20, and they're not getting the results you want to get, you might want to consider having maybe somebody dust it off and just kind of revisit it and make it something else a little bit for you. And those songs that I'm talking about, they will probably come to you over the years after you've tried to, you've been trying to solicit them, and they're not really getting to the ears you want them to get to, or nobody's really feeling it like you are. That to me is when you might want to go in and try some other things and invest some other money, if you believe in those songs.
That's a great answer. Thank you. What are some of the biggest issues that you find that with tracks that guys just bring to you. I worked on this at home. I did it on Logic, and this is what I've got. And you're listening to it, and you go, ah, okay, dang. Okay, how am I going to fix that? What am I going to do? What are some of the ones that stand out to you? That's
once again, that's a tough question.
Yeah.
Because I will say most of the stuff that I get lately, because of the knowledge that's available on the internet and all these tutorials and everybody's talking, you can get information all the time. Yeah. I'm getting a level of I'm getting a level of 50% to 60% most of the time, at least.
That's good. Yeah.
If it's paid for by professionals, I'm getting a level of about 80%, you know?
Yep.
So the level of the professionality of the craft, I don't know if I said that right, but professionalism.
That works.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Has really risen a lot because of all the information that's available. If I get what you just described, it's probably somebody who is just starting it. Well, first of all, I wouldn't probably be doing that.
You probably wouldn't be working on this.
Right, yeah. Right. That's where I was going with that one. Unless somebody's friends, a friend's kid or something, I'm helping them out.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But no, I'm going to get the stuff that's kind of half proficient, because otherwise you're not going to be able to use my talent the way I should be using. You're going to have me going back in the well and fixing all that stuff. I mean, yeah. So I think the whole level has really risen. And I give kudos to everybody out there who are doing their research and their homework. I say to you guys, keep it up. It's working.
Do you have one trick or go-to that you feel okay sharing about mixing vocals in your track that would make this podcast worth listening to for somebody who's like looking for nuggets?
Well, here's the nugget. Open your DAW and just keep doing it every day. You're going to find the formula. I'm sorry. And if you don't find the formula, go do something else.
Ooh.
I don't mean to be an elitist about that, but
no, good.
That's how I've learned it. Nobody told me. I just kept fucking with shit.
Uh-huh.
To be fair,
yeah.
I had great artists on the other side.
Yeah.
I was watching performances. I wasn't sitting there chopping together word and word and word. I mean, I eventually got to that, but I'm watching I can't get the word right now, but I'm watching somebody that's very proficient. I'll pick a Donny Hathaway, somebody he's performing. That's what he's doing. I'm sitting here watching a performance. All I have to make sure is I don't fuck it up. And then when I go to mix it, it knows where to sit because he knew how to sing on top of the track to make him poke the fuck out.
Yeah.
That's not the answer you wanted.
So you know what that sounds like? That sounds almost exactly like what Nico would say. I'm sitting here listening to it. My job's just to capture that, man. Because if the guy is good, it's like the guy that can sit down to the drum set and it can sound like crap. And that's, you can never get that snare to sound worth a shit. And then a Purdy or somebody else will come in and they'll hit it. And it's like, it's the same snare, same mic. Why does it sound so different? Yeah, right. That's okay. I got you.
By the way, that was a perfect analogy because we had a sonar kit in Atlantic Studio that Bernard bought for us.
Uh-huh.
It sounded like horse shit for everybody else. But when Bernard would come in, it would sound freaking amazing.
Yeah.
And matter of fact, it didn't matter what drum kit he played. It always sounded amazing. So, you know, it is in the performance.
Yeah.
And that's what people are looking for. And it's like, there is no performance, so it's really hard to make that stuff sit in there, even for Jimmy.
Yeah.
It's really hard for me to find a place where it really sits and flows with the actual flow of the music.
You know, one of the things I like about a lot of the artists that you work with and the albums, the tracks that you've recorded and mixed, is your work really reflects the artist. It doesn't reflect Jimmy.
Not at all.
Nope. I mean, that's the biggest compliment I could give you because that is, you know, darn it.
No, thank you, man. And you know what? When you said that, I was like, I never think about it.
Mm-hmm.
I just do what works. And you know what? That makes me very proud to even say that because it's not about me. It's about them.
Yeah.
And if you do them right, you'll be fine.
Well, we all know music and your job or the job of a mixer, engineer, producer happens at all hours of the day and night, and especially in the past, but I mean, it just does. It's kind of, you know, I'm an artist. I don't feel like recording till after 1 a.m. I'm an artist. I want my coffee and to get this thing done by 10 a.m., you know? So how do you keep, and I ask this of a lot of people, how do you keep like a healthy work-life balance with the kinds of schedules that you sometimes have to have?
You just do.
Ooh. Do you have a routine?
If I have my druthers and I have a routine, mm-hmm. and I'm allowed to be in charge of the whole spectrum, and if I think about it, when I am producing records, I usually do fall into this, when I'm in charge like that, mm-hmm. I will basically, like, I kind of wake up pretty early, actually, but then I get out and I go work out or do something to help continue to make, from my body, because, yeah. you know, if your body ain't cool, you ain't cool. Everything falls apart. So I got to maintain him. He's the guy who keeps me here. Yeah. He houses my whole shit. I do that. Then I probably grab a couple calls or two to kind of see what's going to happen, mm-hmm. that, you know, little administration, whatever. And then I'll usually end up in the studio somewhere around, you know, 1, 2, maybe 3. And I'll work for a good, I'm a good 12-hour worker.
Wow.
I mean, that's kind of, I've been doing it my whole, you know, and then I go to, I'm done, and then I wake up early again. I've been blessed so far, or whatever they say, because I've been reading stuff and they say I'm going to die early, but I've been able to run on like between 5 and 6 hours of sleep for like bunches of years, and that's all I need. And when people say, yeah, but you need this and that, I go, I would like you guys to understand one thing. I don't use an alarm clock. I haven't used an alarm clock probably in 30 years because my body just goes, time to get up. And I wake up and I look and I go, I feel like getting up. Yeah. So what's wrong with that?
There's nothing at all wrong with that. I have a friend that somehow, I don't know how he does it. He's probably 50. I don't know. But he says, I sleep 3-4 hours every night, and I've always slept 3 or 4 hours a night, and that's it. And he never, man, I'm a 4 o'clock, it's time for a nap guy.
I can do that, John. Definitely.
If I was starting out and I wanted to do what Jimmy Douglas does, what would be your best advice for me to get started and get my foot in the door and get rolling?
That's a tough one, because quite honestly, I look around every day and I go, I don't even know where I would start if I had to start when I started now. The playing field on one hand is more accessible because of social media and different ways that people can independently shine and be seen if they do the work. It's a lot of work involved in anything that you do. Let's face it, nothing is just given to you. Nothing ever was just given to you. People think that, oh, you had a great life. I was like, it wasn't given, man. They made me feel like I'm never going to, it's never going to happen for me. Of course. Yeah. And, you know, one of the things I used to always think was like, I was born too late. All the good shit happened. It's never going to happen again. And, you know, and I end up flipping it, whatever, it happens. But the point is, it's a lot of being very tenacious about what you do, just staying in there and hanging in there and repeat, being relentless about your dedication, you know. I used to say, I'm not sure it really holds weight, but like, if you are serious about trying to do this and you put your energy into it every day and you focus and you do whatever, you will not be denied. That's what I say. I used to say that back in the day, and most people that I know, it might have taken them 10, 20 years to do it, but eventually they end up shining in a place they may not have imagined, i.e. example. They wanted to be the rock star. Well, first of all, there's no rock anymore, but the star, and you know, they kept doing it. You know, it's a great example. Okay. These guys called the Alessi Brothers. Ahmed had signed them, and I remember their record. They were called Barnaby By. Pepe Castro was in them, and they were like the poster childs, two twins, and they looked great. Da da da. They got Ahmed Erdogan behind them, for Christ's sake, right? Made the record, sounded amazing. Didn't do shit. And I didn't understand. Once again, I'm a kid myself looking, going, this is going to be the top of the world. Well, it doesn't always work that way. But the two brothers, the Alessi brothers, they kept at it. But they kept at it, and they allowed the universe to present to them other ways of doing it. Like maybe they weren't going to be the rock stars they thought. They ended up being jingle moguls. And I'm saying making crazy bank doing jingles.
You're kind of a deep guy, you know. No, you got some. No, you got some deep answers, because that's exactly what happened to me.
Okay,
I told my band. I said, if I'm not a rock star by the time I'm 35, I'm done. Well, 35, 2 weeks later, I had quit the band.
Oh,
and I went out and I started. You know, I was already a recording engineer, so I ended up starting a couple recording studios. I opened up a film company. And I ended up composing music for Disney and Universal. And then I ended up doing commercial work, you know, ads and stuff. And it gave me enough money that today I don't have to work for it. So
I love it.
But you know what? I loved playing that, you know, I didn't mind working in 30 or 60 seconds. You know, I thought it was cool because in the way my mind works, man, it's like I'd love to change stuff like this. You know, I couldn't do film scores worth a shit. I tried to do three of them, and they all sucked because the way my mind works, I couldn't do a melody that took a minute to unfold. If you wanted a melody that happened in a second and a half, I was your guy. So I love that answer. It leads to other things in our industry that keep you close to the music. Jimmy, this has been awesome, man. Thank you. I'm glad we were able to finally connect here and talk a little bit. You're a lovely man, and I really appreciate you sharing time with me.
Thank you for your spirit, man. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Theme music for Gig with Mike Redman was composed and produced by Other Animal. Thank you for joining me today for another episode of Gig with Mike Redman. If you like what you heard, I'd ask that you subscribe and like us. And finally, if you have questions about a job or ideas for an episode, contact me at gigwithmikeredman@gmail.com. Until next time, I'm Mike Redman, signing off.